The Tom Woods Show, episode 2359.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, believing that the end of the world might be a bad thing that we should try to avoid is not a Russian talking point. But if we are going to avoid World War III, it's important for Americans to understand what's been left out of the CIA's narrative about Russia and Ukraine. Coming to the rescue here is my brand new free ebook, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About Ukraine. Pick it up at wrongaboutukraine.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Well, Harvard's in the news, also the University of North Carolina, because of the Supreme Court decision essentially saying you cannot engage in affirmative action in university admissions. So I thought I would talk a little bit about that, and then I probably want to transition into something else. I wrote an issue in my email newsletter about this the other day because I happen to be on the Harvard alumni email list. So I received an email that, of course, most people don't receive, and I felt like I had an obligation to share that email because of, well, I think for reasons that'll be obvious in a minute. But the gist of the court's position, which was delivered 6-3, written by Justice Roberts, was that you can't do this because it violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. I don't really want to get into that. I'm tired of talking about the 14th Amendment. I'll put on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/2359, an episode or two related to the 14th Amendment and why I always feel like it's slippery to use it because it's almost always being used for something beyond the fairly modest purposes it was originally intended for. So I prefer not to go down that road. But this is where we are. Everybody uses the 14th Amendment, so this is where we are. I know I did an episode with Kevin Gutzman on previous court decisions relating to race and affirmative action, so try and dig that one out as well. As a matter of fact, let me write that down because I'm a little absent-minded these days. But you know what? Before I read the letter that I got from Harvard today, I guess yesterday at this point, I just want you to know just how extreme Harvard's policies have been. This isn't just, well, it's a toss-up between two candidates and they're equally qualified, but this one is of one race and this one is of a different race. It's not even anywhere in the ballpark of that. So Harvard uses something that it calls its academic index. So it integrates test scores and GPA and comes up with this thing called the academic index. And then we can look at students of different races and their academic index scores and then see the rates at which they were admitted to Harvard. So for instance, if you're Asian and you're in the fourth lowest decile of this index of students being considered for admission to Harvard in a given year, you have essentially no chance of being admitted to Harvard, a 0.9% chance. But if you're Black and in the fourth lowest decile, you have a 12.8% chance of being admitted. Whereas if you are Asian and in the top decile, the very top decile, you have only a 12.7% chance even then. That's how wide the disparities are. So we can go through whites. If they're in the top 10%, then 15.3% chance. Hispanics, 31.3% chance. And Blacks, 56.1%. Now, here is the important section. I mean, I think this is probably, now that I think about it, I think I left only one paragraph out and it was just a concluding goodbye paragraph. This is the email we received. Today, the Supreme Court delivered its decision in Students for Fair Admissions versus President and Fellows of Harvard College. The court held that Harvard College's admissions system does not comply with the principles of the Equal Protection Clause embodied in Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. Court also ruled that colleges and universities may consider in admissions decisions, quote, an applicant's discussion of how race affected his or her life, be it through discrimination, inspiration, or otherwise, unquote. We will certainly comply with the court's decision. Now, I think that's a little bit slippery. Do they mean we're going to comply with that one sentence and pretend that that constitutes the entire decision? Nobody knows. Then we go on to read this. We write today to reaffirm the fundamental principle that deep and transformative teaching, learning, and research depend upon a community comprising people of many backgrounds, perspectives, and lived experiences. That principle is as true and important today as it was yesterday. So too are the abiding values that have enabled us and every great educational institution to pursue the high calling of educating creative thinkers and bold leaders, of deepening human knowledge, and of promoting progress, justice, and human flourishing. We affirm that because the teaching, learning, research, and creativity that bring progress and change require debate and disagreement. Diversity and difference are essential to academic excellence. To prepare leaders for a complex world, Harvard must admit and educate a student body whose members reflect and have lived multiple facets of human experience. No part of what makes us who we are could ever be irrelevant. Harvard must always be a place of opportunity, a place whose doors remain open to those to whom they had long been closed, a place where many will have the chance to live dreams their parents or grandparents could not have dreamed. For almost a decade, Harvard has vigorously defended an admissions system that, as two federal courts ruled, fully complied with longstanding precedent. In the weeks and months ahead, drawing on the talent and expertise of our Harvard community, we will determine how to preserve, consistent with the court's new precedent, our essential values. Now, what does that mean? Drawing on the talent and expertise of our Harvard community, we will determine how to preserve our essential values. I take that as we're going to figure out a way around this. What else could that mean? You think these people are going to give up on their obsessions because they're told no? I had somebody write to me and say, well, you wouldn't give up on your obsessions if you were told no, because I don't have obsessions. That's the thing. These people insist on viewing the world through this incorrect lens that race determines everything, all statistical disparities are caused by racism, and all that. That's all false. Just read a couple of Thomas Sowell books, and it's overwhelming, the case that that's all false. So I think what's going to happen is you're going to start to see universities now doing what's been happening in the rest of society. The rest of society, if you can't get the racial results you want, you just drop the requirements that prevent you from getting that result. So if there's a civil service test that blacks and Hispanics aren't passing at high enough rates, you either get rid of the test or you make it so easy that every group gets a 100% pass rate. That's how they handle it. They don't say, well, sorry, you're going to have to work harder. Sorry, you're just going to have to work harder. Forget that. That is never the answer. That is always wrong. That is never the answer. So what I think they'll do instead is start elevating other aspects of people's applications, move away from objective criteria that might be connected to academic performance, and instead say, we're going to take a holistic approach and we're going to have this or that woo-woo requirement that will conceal what it is they're really doing, even though we'll all know what they're doing, but it'll be harder to prove what they're doing. It'll be harder to prove this is all just to maintain the injustices they've been carrying out. Now, I received from a friend of mine, forwarded email from whoever runs the Connecticut State Colleges and Universities organization. And in this email, we get this. This is from whoever, I don't know who's the president of this. Message clipped, view entire message. Let me find it. Office of the Chancellor. It's not signed by anybody. Office of the Chancellor of the Connecticut State Colleges and Universities. It should be alarming for all of us in higher education. In other words, this decision. Chiefly because race-conscious admissions are by far the most effective means of increasing diversity at selective schools. What is that saying? I mean, I think you're supposed to be a little more subtle than that. In other words, the only way we can get the number of people in particular groups into these universities is if we just pluck them out of society and put them there. There's no other way to do it. It doesn't work. That's what he's saying. It doesn't work. And it reminds me of my conversation with Heather McDonald. We were talking about symphony orchestras. Now, remember, symphony orchestras have their auditions behind a screen so as to prevent there being any bias related to any characteristics of the person. Well, that doesn't yield the results that the crazies want. So now they're actually saying they should get rid of the screen so that they can see the race of the person, so that they can choose somebody they would not have chosen otherwise on the basis of that person's skill. Because, of course, when you go to see a symphony orchestra, you think, I don't want to see the very best. I just want to see everybody who tried. That's not why we go. That is not why we go. This letter goes on to point out that Proposition 209 in California, 1996, passed by California voters, banned affirmative action, and that meant that the percentage of Black and Latino students in those, you know, like at UCLA or UC Berkeley, fell very substantially. And then from the letter, despite more than two decades of intensive and expensive efforts, the UC system continues to be less diverse than the state's demographic makeup. So imagine that. More than two decades of intensive and expensive efforts, they cannot get this difference to go away. Just as Jackson, the most recent appointee, of course, has the usual, what you would expect, blather and nothingness. So we read, The only way out of this morass for all of us is to stare at racial disparity unblinkingly and then do what evidence and experts tell us is required to level the playing field and march forward together, collectively striving to achieve true equality for all Americans. It is no small irony that the judgment the majority hands down today will forestall the end of race-based disparities in this country, making the colorblind world the majority wistfully touts much more difficult to accomplish. So again, the race-based disparities, there are a million reasons that there are race-based disparities, a million of them. And only one of them is somebody arbitrarily and irrationally says, because of this person's background or skin, I'm not going to hire that person. That is almost never the explanation. So for instance, if we look at Asian and Black PhDs, Asian PhDs get paid way, way more than Black PhDs. Now, why is that? Because people who hire people who have terminal degrees tend to want to stick it to Black people and to elevate Asian people? Is that, you know, are you going to be that juvenile? That's our analysis? Well, how about you peel back a little bit the numbers and look at those numbers and compare apples to apples. What do these two groups tend to have PhDs in? Well, the Asians tend to have PhDs in engineering, chemistry-related fields, whereas fully half of Black PhDs are in education. I would guess that the percentage of Asian PhDs in education is in the single digits, and I would even guess low single digits. Is education a high-paying field? I think we all know the answer to that. So there's your answer. Notice how I didn't have to refer to the Ku Klux Klan or quote-unquote systemic racism or anything. I just looked at actually what's being compared with what. Or why is it that Polish Americans have much higher net worths than Puerto Ricans? Why is that? Because everybody prefers Polish people and there have been special consideration given to Polish people? Really? To Polish people specifically? Well, how about the fact that on average, Polish people are 25 years older? So they've had 25 extra years to accumulate a net worth. How about that? Anybody going to bother looking at that? Of course, nobody will. Oh, and by the way, this means we're going to need thousands and thousands of extra lawyers who will have a vested interest in keeping this whole nonsense up. Oh, and we're going to need entire federal agencies, and we're going to need thousands and thousands of enforcers, and again, all of whom have a vested interest in keeping this up. Now, this is all about correcting injustice, you understand. This has nothing to do with feathering our nests or creating a huge array of cushy jobs for discrimination, spies, and enforcers. No, we identify a problem that by its very nature can't ever go away because there are just too many differences between all the different groups in America for them ever to have equal outcomes ever. That is absolutely impossible, could never happen. And that's why they love it, because it means they will never, ever be out of a job. They'll never, ever be without power. They'll be able to favor their favored constituencies from now until the end of the world. Justice Jackson goes on to quote Garrison Frazier, a former slave, talking about what freedom meant to him. And she's got this big quotation that's very moving, but as Richard Hanania says, you have to remind yourself that this is a case about whether Blacks should be able to get into schools with lower test scores. That's what it's about. All this extra melodrama has nothing to do with anything apart from obscuring the actual issue at hand with appeals to emotion rather than logic. Oh, and remember, by the way, remember, Harvard says no part of what makes us who we are could ever be irrelevant. But that's obviously not what they believe, because they believe that the only parts of who you are that are relevant are if you're Black, Hispanic, or trans. That's basically the three things where they really care. If you're Asian, well, they'll look the other way and they'll let you in because they probably have to. But what other thing are they taking into account? Are they saying, we need to have more Catholic traditionalists here because now there's a marginalized group. They haven't got any representatives anywhere in any part of society. Talk about marginalized. And yet, they have a lot of very interesting things to say about a great many subjects. So we're going to make an extra effort to recruit them. Yeah, right. Yeah. Let's recruit more evangelical Christians because their voices are not as loud as they used to be. Or we need more Scandinavians in our schools. We're not exposed enough to Scandinavians. So we're going to make sure we thought would never occur to them. Would never occur to them because that's not ever what this has ever been about. This has never been about, We need to have a multiplicity of perspectives all coming together so that we can all learn from each other. That is not ever what it was about. It was about rewarding different groups. That was it. That was it. It was about politics all the way through. Because if you really wanted to have a variety of experiences, you would not have an admissions policy that results in a student body, every last one of whom thinks exactly the same way, with, I can assure you, only a very, very tiny dissenting sliver. I'm telling you, it is a sliver of students who dissent. And if they produce that type of student body year after year after year after year, it is impossible to think that that's happening by accident. Now, incidentally, this case came up tonight in discussion with several of my daughters. They wanted to know what I thought about it. I'm sure they had a sense of what I thought about it, but they wanted some details. And one of them said, well, if the goal is to help people who are at a disadvantage, then why wouldn't they target the affirmative action at people who simply have low incomes? Because then you might be able to say, well, for sure, we know that everybody with low incomes has had a real struggle to get to whatever level they've reached. And so maybe that says something for them. Maybe they might merit some special consideration. But why does it have to be racial in nature? Why couldn't the help just be based on income? And I thought, ah, you naive child. I don't know how you managed to acquire this naivete living under this roof. But the answer is that this is intended to be a spoil system. That's what it is. It's a program established by race hustlers who may give lip service to some generalized concern about opportunity among the least advantaged, but they don't actually mean that. They just mean, I want more resources transferred to my group. That's what they really mean. So all the flowery generalities boil down to more resources for my group. We demand it. Before I go on, let me say a quick thing that will help a lot of you, and you know who you are. If you are in business and you're getting buried by your competition online, then build your brand, your reputation, and your lead flow with digital marketing by Persist SEO, our great sponsor. If you're a small local business, you're trying to compete against large companies in the service industry, increase your visibility with Persist SEO. Or if you have low or no leads coming in on a consistent basis, well, website search engine and conversion optimization can help move the needle to a more prosperous business model for you. If you're tired of cold calling, use your website as a lead generation engine. If you're not showing up for your services on the search engines, then get found with Persist SEO's expert search engine optimization. All you have to do is call 770-580-3736 or visit them at ineedseo.help for a free website audit and consultation. That's 770-580-3736 or ineedseo.help. Now, there was a case 20 years ago in 2003 in which the court said, look, this type of program at the very least has to have some type of sunset provision. This obviously cannot go on forever. You can't just forever go on giving benefits to members of certain groups at the expense of other groups. You have to knock this off. Eventually, we get to a point where it's no longer plausible to make the kinds of arguments you're making, and this offense against the natural American sense of justice has to cease at some point. Whereas what the court is essentially saying now is that, well, obviously there's no end in sight. The universities are not making any effort to wind these programs down. To the contrary, they're, if anything, increasing the number of bureaucrats dedicated to it and seemingly boasting that they intend to continue along this path more or less forever. And indeed, when you look at the Harvard admission process, it is just obsessed with race. So the very first step, the process, begins with a first reader. And the first reader who gives an overall rating to the candidate takes that candidate's race into account. Then the candidate gets moved on to a subcommittee, and the subcommittee takes the candidate's race into account. Then at the end of the process, when they're considering which candidates to cut, yet again, a third time in the process, they take race into account. The court also catches Harvard in an obvious contradiction. Because on the one hand, Harvard is trying to say, oh, you're exaggerating the extent to which we take race into account. It's not a big deal, and it doesn't really affect that many candidates. But at the same time, Harvard is also saying, but if you don't let us obsess constantly over race, we're not going to get nearly the demographic balance that we want. Come on now, right? We can all see through that. Those two things can't coexist together. Those two statements don't work side by side. Then there's an interesting chart that the court provides looking at the share of the class of 2009, 2010, 11, all the way down through 2019, the share of each Harvard class occupied by members of different races. So for instance, in the class of 2009, 11% of the class was Black, 8% Hispanic, 18% Asian. But then when you look down 2009, 10, 11, 12, you look over the course of all these years, and you find that this balance stays pretty much the same. The percentage of Black students fluctuates only between the range of 10 to 12%. And the percentage of Hispanics goes from a low, 2009 was a low of 8%, and then to a high of 12%. Even that's unusual. So it's generally somewhere between 9 and 11% every single year. And the Asian proportion, again, is between about 18 and 20% every single year. Now, what are the odds of that just happening at random? Doesn't this instead look like Harvard has decided that we're going to allow Asians to occupy this many seats and no more? And so implicitly also whites. We're going to allow whites to occupy this many seats and no more because we need to have this many occupied by this or that other group. The majority opinion actually makes fun of Justice Sotomayor in her dissent. Sotomayor, of course, is a dope. I mean, the way she handled COVID, everything she said was completely idiotic, worse than Fauci. Even Fauci wasn't making the bizarre claim she was making. But Sotomayor is complaining about that chart because she says, well, you're just looking at a truncated period. Justice Roberts also, in effect, makes fun of Justice Sotomayor, who is not bright. As you know, not bright, for the way she tries to handle the problem posed by that chart that I just mentioned that clearly indicates there's a deliberate racial plan motivating Harvard's admission decisions and says, obviously, Harvard must use precise racial preferences year in and year out to maintain the unyielding demographic composition of its class. And so the best Sotomayor can do is to say, well, you handpicked 2009 to 2019. That's a truncated period. And a way to prove that, she thinks, is to show that Asian students at Harvard varied significantly from 1980 to 1994. And as Justice Roberts says, a 14-year period that ended nearly three decades ago. He says the relevance of that observation, handpicked and truncated as it is lost on us. It does not and cannot dispute that the share of Black and Hispanic students at Harvard, described as the primary beneficiaries of its race-based admissions policy, has remained consistent for decades. The dissents are trying to claim that it's all a coincidence and we have to trust what the experts tell us, and the experts are saying that race plays only a minor role, and they use holistic and contextual judgments. But Roberts says, for all the talk of holistic and contextual judgments, the racial preferences at issue here, in fact, operate like clockwork. Now, I also want to point out that Roberts may have tried to anticipate the plan that I suggested universities might try to follow at this point, that they'll take that one sentence that says, nothing in this opinion should be construed as prohibiting universities from considering an applicant's discussion of how race affected his or her life, be it through discrimination, inspiration, or otherwise. They're going to focus on that sentence, and then they're going to let essay questions and application essays give them a holistic view of the candidate, and maybe they'll do that in that way without placing so much emphasis on GPA and test scores, which are objective and measurable, and we can all see they're discriminating against members of groups that scored higher, they'll just fall back on something like this. But Roberts actually says in the decision, Despite the dissent's assertion to the contrary, universities may not simply establish through application essays or other means the regime we hold unlawful today. And then, really snarky, he says in parentheses, because it's in the dissenting opinions that you hear reference to that language. And so he says in parentheses, a dissenting opinion is generally not the best source of legal advice on how to comply with the majority opinion. Now, incidentally, I think you will enjoy reading the concurring opinion of Justice Thomas, because I find him to be the most interesting one to read. Gorsuch can be interesting to read, but Thomas is just scathing over and over. And so in this decision, among other things, he's curious to know, what exactly are these educational benefits that are supposed to accrue to a university by having a quote-unquote diverse student body? And of course, I put that in quotation marks because that's a farce. That's the last thing in the world they have. They do not for a second think of making special efforts to recruit truly marginalized communities, communities that don't have celebrity spokesmen and months dedicated to them, and I mean, genuinely marginalized and hated and constantly attacked and ridiculed and mocked and blasphemed. Those groups, you can just forget about it. But anyway, so Justice Thomas wants to know, what are the actual educational benefits that supposedly accrue to students by being around such a community? Because the universities are claiming that without affirmative action, we can't foster the kind of learning environment we want that they say surely does have educational benefits. So Thomas says, I have sought over the past 20 years to understand exactly how racial diversity yields educational benefits, educational in italics. And he says, with nearly 50 years to develop their arguments, neither Harvard nor UNC, two of the foremost research institutions in the world, can explain that critical link. He says, Harvard offers a report finding that meaningful representation of racial minorities promotes several goals. Only one of those goals, quote, producing new knowledge stemming from diverse outlooks, unquote, bears any possible relationship to educational benefits. Yet it too is extremely vague and offers no indication that, for example, student test scores increased as a result of Harvard's efforts toward racial diversity. Well, then, the Biden administration itself tried to argue that there was some educational benefit from, quote, racial diversity. And so, as Justice Thomas writes, the government offers only one study purportedly showing that, quote, college diversity experiences are significantly and positively related to cognitive development, unquote, and that, quote, interpersonal interactions with racial diversity are the most strongly related to cognitive development, unquote. And again, Thomas says, here again, the link is at best tenuous, unspecified, and stereotypical. And then Thomas takes a moment to make fun of Justice Sotomayor. He says, Justice Sotomayor apparently believes that race-conscious admissions programs can somehow increase the chances that members of certain races, blacks and Hispanics, are admitted without decreasing the chances of admission for members of other races, Asians. This simply defies mathematics, he says. In a zero-sum game like college admissions, any sorting mechanism that takes race into account in any way has discriminated based on race to the benefit of some races and the detriment of others. And I'm very happy to see Justice Thomas actually quoting Thomas Sowell in his opinion. He says, even in the segregated South where I grew up, individuals were not the sum of their skin color. Then as now, not all disparities are based on race, not all people are racist, and not all differences between individuals are ascribable to race. Put simply, quote, and this is the quotation from Sowell, the fate of abstract categories of wealth statistics is not the same as the fate of a given set of flesh and blood human beings, unquote. Worse still, Thomas continues, Justice Jackson uses her broad observations about statistical relationships between race and select measures of health, wealth, and well-being to label all blacks as victims. Her desire to do so is unfathomable to me. Such a view is irrational, he says. It is an insult to individual achievement and cancerous to young minds seeking to push through barriers rather than consign themselves to permanent victimhood. And then Thomas says, if an applicant has less financial means because of generational inheritance or otherwise, then surely a university may take that into account. If an applicant has medical struggles or a family member with medical concerns, a university may consider that too. What it cannot do is use the applicant's skin color as a heuristic, assuming that because the applicant checks the box for black, he therefore conforms to the university's monolithic and reductionist view of an abstract, average black person. Anyway, I do recommend reading the Thomas opinion, if not the entire decision, just for the sheer fun of it, just watching him at work. I always enjoy reading what he has to say. But what I think will be interesting here is that the very people who have lectured us and lectured us and lectured us about the importance of the rule of law, what I think will be particularly interesting to see is what these people, who are the sorts of people who for years have been lecturing us about the rule of law, what these people do in the face of law they don't like, interpretation they don't like. What are they going to do? The rule of law says they need to comply with this decision. Are they going to? If they don't, then, well, we're confirmed in what we thought about their real opinion about the rule of law. That really, the rule of law just means whatever benefits me is what I'm going to pursue. And if sometimes operating according to, quote, the law redounds to my benefit, then I will do that. Or if I can twist the law so that it benefits me, I can call that adhering to the rule of law. But if adhering to the rule of law does not benefit me, then I won't do it. And that is the Bolshevik mentality, absolutely. And I'm not one to throw terms around like that loosely, but that was the Bolshevik attitude, that whatever advances the revolution is legally acceptable. That was the way they thought. And I absolutely am convinced that that is the way people we're fighting against today think. And it's a scary thing. But very, very interesting decision by the court. I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/2359. And next week, I'm going to be in London for the week. So I hope you won't mind that I release maybe 2 to 3 episodes next week so I can have a little time off. I've got 2 of my daughters going to London for the first time. And so we're just going to do fun touristy things. I'm not doing any public speaking or anything while I'm there. Just having some fun. It's a city I love. Haven't been there since February 2020. And during the darkest times, I wondered if I'd ever be able to go back. So I will be very happy to be there. And I will be having meals with a couple of Tom Woods Show guests, our friend Dominic Frisbee. You remember Kisses on a Postcard? And of course, our old friend James Dellingpole. So I'm going to have a great time over there. You'll probably be getting updates and pictures as part of my regular newsletter. So if you're not getting the newsletter, tisk tisk, go to tomwoods.com, sign up for the ebook right at the top of the screen. That will add you to the newsletter list. Thanks, everybody.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.